The following content is explicit. It's Thursday, May 10th, 2018, from Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today, in the spiel, and right here, right now, I will give the show over to one issue. Torture. It's a fun issue. Should we torture? No. Do we torture? We do. We have. It's not who we are, John McCain says. Yeah, it is. Shouldn't be, but it is. I actually don't mind one bit that some of those architects of 9/11 were made to endure suffering. Fuck them. I'm upset that it's Americans who are the ones who did the fucking. Torture is not about them, it is about us. Anyway, that is in the spiel. Here I want to talk about a real torture, which is the tortuous path a lot of news organizations take to avoid plainly stating the facts. A fact like shoving a tube up the bottom of a person and pumping hummus and raisins in is to, quote, an enhanced technique, what Essential and Consulting is to giving some money to Michael Cohen. And we did that, by the way. We did that rectal feeding. Taxpayer dollars there. We bought the tube. We pureed the raisins. But in reporting on the Haspel hearings, you heard constructions like this on ABC.
Haspel once reportedly led a black site prison in Thailand, where terror suspects were waterboarded. Critics call it torture.
Four-week-old fish, which critics call stinky. Here's NBC.
On Capitol Hill today, the first woman to be nominated to lead the CIA, Gina Haspel, faced tough questions at her Senate confirmation hearing about her 30 years as a spy and about her role in a harsh interrogation tactic that critics say amounted to torture.
Oh, those critics again. Get a Yelp account, lady. And to complete the trifecta, CBS.
For a time, she oversaw a prison where suspects were tortured.
Wait, did you hear that? Oversaw a prison where suspects were tortured. So it's possible. It's possible to be plain in your language and accurate with your descriptions. CBS News, you get the first GIST award for calling torture torture. There will be no award ceremony, but it is okay because the banquet was going to feature hummus. On the show today, sorry to torture you, more torture in the spiel, but first, to the greens of Sawgrass. Today, the Players' Championship Golf Tournament is underway, and more attention will be paid to the 92nd ranked player in the world than any other golfer, and that is because he is Tiger Woods. He is no longer a dominant golfer. He, remember, drove into a tree, injured his shoulder after his wife found out about his affair. This dominated both sports and the tabloid press. So no longer dominant as a golfer, but he is still a dominant story. And now a better told and better chronicled one than ever before. Armin Katayan and Jeff Benedict have written a broad and masterful biography of Tiger Woods, one that should fascinate even a person who doesn't know a bogey from a birdie. Tiger Woods is perhaps the greatest golfer who ever lived. Now, if I asked myself 10 years ago, would I be saying the word perhaps as a qualifier in that sentence in 2018? I'd have had to have predicted no. By then, I would say he would have amassed the most Masters titles and just established himself as beyond the greatest golfer ever to live, but probably the greatest individual athlete ever to live and possibly the greatest athlete ever to live. So what happened? We all know what happened, but we don't really understand it until now. There is a new biography, Tiger Woods. It is by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. Normally, I have many outlets where I talk sports, but normally I don't do it on this show. But this was such a transcendent biography of a transcendent figure. I think that there is a lot of things that go way beyond golf in trying to understand the person that was Tiger Woods. Jeff is here in studio. Armin is on the phone. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
So you start by comparing him to Shakespeare, and I get the point that, this is a transcendent figure. Why limit it to the world of sports? And, of course, nothing was the same after Shakespeare. Here's who I think of him like Mozart. Just because you have the four-year-old genius, you have the domineering father, and you have that child prodigy who indeed goes way past that and becomes one of the greatest in his field. Is that a fair comparison, you think?
That was our number two. That was our number two choice.
Yeah, it was. And we actually read somewhere where he had been, Dave Kindred had referred to him as, made a Mozart comparison back when Tiger was at his peak. And I think it's fair. There's probably never been, at least in my lifetime, an athlete that draws eyeballs the way he does. I mean, even when he's not competing, if he's walking through an airport, if he's coming out of a hotel, if he's getting into a taxi cab, people want to look at this man. They want to be near him. He's hard to turn away from, even when he's not performing. When he is performing, it's like magic. You're always wondering, are you going to see something today that you've never seen before?
When you consider that Tiger won about a quarter of every tournament that he entered, he won 7 out of 11 majors in a row, you know, in one stretch in golf. He won 8 tournaments in 1 year. He was the player of the year 11 times. He was the scoring leader 9 times. He had this indomitable will that just broke people's wills. And in many cases, guys were afraid to be in the last twosome with him on Sunday. They would rather have been one pairing ahead rather than play with him because they just didn't want to deal with Tiger mania.
Yeah, Frank DeFord had this line about Jimmy Connors. I hope I get it exactly right. He was raised by women to conquer men. I think that was the verb.
Yeah, that's it.
So Tiger Woods was raised by his dad and his mom, but his dad deployed this sort of psychological warfare. I wouldn't wish this on anyone, but I think of the idea of the Skinner box where he was almost raised in a laboratory to be Tiger Woods.
I think that's an interesting word choice, a laboratory. It's a word that Armin and I actually used a lot when we were working on the narrative and trying to figure out, you know, the right kind of comparisons to make. And Earl is such a dominant figure.
Earl Woods, yeah.
The whole father-son relationship is fascinating. But Earl is so dominant that he completely overshadowed Cultita. And so when we were crafting the narrative, one of the things we
Tiger's
wanted
to— Tiger's mom, Cultita.
Yeah, Tiger's mom is, in our mind, she's equally responsible for everything that happened, good and bad. As Earl is, but she was overshadowed so much because Earl always controlled Tiger's narrative. You know, former soldier from Vietnam, a Green Beret, who's using these tactics that he taught in warfare school on his 14-year-old son. You're building someone who is more like a machine than a man.
Did he have physical gifts, or was that actually willed onto him as his father demonstrated a golf swing to the 14-month-old, and it was sort of impressed upon him like Conrad Lorenz and the Ducklings?
When you see him swinging a club at 2, and there is video footage of that, so you can look at it. It's not like we're making this up.
So right now, I'd like you to meet Tiger Woods and his father, Earl Woods.
You can see when he's 2, the way he swings a club, that's not natural. That's not normal. And that's not from Earl. That's Tiger. That is nature. That's not nurture. But on top of that, he has this regimen that's instilled in him from the time he's in a high chair. First, he's watching over and over and over and over the same thing. It's not a television. It's live action, his father swinging in a garage.
When you have that kind of almost unimaginable experiment that comes to life, you get somebody like Tiger Woods. The question that beyond who is he is, what's the price of that genius? What's on the other side of that? When we watch and we get thrilled and we're in awe of what he did on a Sunday afternoon in a major, we never really thought, really, until we started to work on the book, what's the price of that genius? What's the cost of transcendent stardom? And it's not a great answer. It's not a pretty picture a lot of the time.
When you raise a kid like Tiger Woods was raised, where the concept of empathy or other people is unbelievably foreign to you, you raise either a genius or a monster. And in Tiger Woods, they raised, it would appear, a genius and a monster. To what extent did his failings as a human actually help him at golf?
I think it helped him a lot. I think he was
I think you're right.
You could argue that nice guys don't necessarily finish with 79 tour wins and 14 majors and become the first billion-dollar athlete. You weren't going to beat Tiger, and it didn't happen until 2009 at the at the PGA when Y.E. Yang beat him for the first time when Tiger was leading a tournament in a major. So you add all that together, and it's just the kind of thing that golf had really never seen before, that kind of mentality.
Flip side of that, of course, is unfortunately, you know, Tiger has this history of severing relationships with people that were intimate with him, that were close to him, that were people he seemingly cared a great deal about and who certainly cared a great deal about him. He has that same cold ability to shut that out, shut people off, just like he would when he's on the golf course. He has that same approach to human relationships that he has to the competitive relationships inside the ropes. And we saw tragic story after story that we told in the book from, you know, really from the first girl that he ever loved, that he ever had an intimate relationship with in high school, all the way up through the present.
Yeah, his breakup letter was quite a thing.
It's cold. and when you,
it's cold. It's non-factual. It's out of nowhere. Yeah, it's ruthless. That's a word for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and it
was, shouldn't do anything. And he was like, I don't want you in my life ever again.
And they never spoke again. It's amazing when you think about having a human relationship with someone where there is some intimacy, there's actually some love and caring, and you're together for 3 years all the time. And then in one day, not only do you break it off with a letter in writing, but you literally never speak again for the rest of your life, not a phone call. And
this was a guy who had very few intimates. And so she was filling the role that a normal person might have a few people fill.
She had a huge role. And he did love her. There's no question about that. Her parents loved him. They treated him like a son. He was like a part of that family. And so you can go on and on. His first lawyer, John Merchant, who guided him from the amateur career and helped him raise tens of thousands of dollars to play on the amateur tour all the way into his turning pro, he was like a godfather figure who was a mentor and a great influence, an African-American who could show him the ropes. And literally in one day, gone, severed. When Armin and I interviewed John Merchant, which we did three times in person, we were stunned when he said, I have never spoken to Tiger Woods since the day I was fired. It's like, you've got to be kidding me. But there's a whole litany of people.
Charles
like that.
Barkley, after the 2009 accident, reached out, tried to reach out to Tiger to, as a friend, just to offer what friends do, sympathy, encouragement, a shoulder to cry on, whatever you needed. He has not talked to Tiger since before November 27, 2009. As Jeff said, there's a crash pile of people that have intersected with Tiger at certain points of their lives, and then only to be amputated when Tiger deemed they were no longer useful to him. It was very much, up until very recently, a one-way street. Tiger Woods' way, and it was his way, was the only way.
The difference between Woods and other people, famous people who have flown too close to the sun or gotten a comeuppance, is there's usually the role of enablers. And it's not as if Tiger Woods didn't have people either on the payroll or lackeys who were, you know, trying to curry favor with Tiger Woods. But he seemed to be driving it to a greater extent than anyone else that I have ever read about who finds himself caught in scandal. He's even in his destruction, he was an island unto himself.
I actually think that Tiger, he is much more successful because he was born to be alone. He is a self-professed introvert. He's always been an introvert. He is about himself. He wants to be alone. One of the most interesting things, we interviewed the guy who taught him how to scuba dive and then who taught him how to spearfish. And he did say, by the way, that he only needed one lesson for spearfishing, and he was better than the teacher, which does speak to the coordination. But the point is this is a guy who said one of his favorite places to his favorite place to be on Earth, other than inside the ropes, is deep beneath the sea on the ocean floor.
Yeah.
Why? Because there are no people there.
And he also likes SEAL training in the mountains, in the rugged mountainous region where you don't have to deal with
That's
anyone
right.
else.
And so I think that does help inform when you're trying to figure out the, you know, who knew? about all this secret life? Well, the caddy must have known. The swing coach must have known. His wife must have known. They didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
These were the people that were the closest to him, and they did not know. That's not a lie. I mean, he kept all of this inside.
Since his, since it all came out, all the affairs he was having, since his personal problems, since that weird press conference that I actually covered from a different room, I think, at TPC at Sawgrass than when he was actually speaking in, just this bizarre spectacle. What's the evidence that you found that he really has been trying to change and grow?
What's really fascinating is that in the last 9 years, he's been through an amazing number of personal tragedies and trials that just one of those by themselves would be enough to crush most people. I mean, the sex infidelity scandal alone was probably the biggest one we've ever seen play out for an athlete. It was over the top how big it was, and it triggered this precipitous fall from grace. It also sent him to sex addiction treatment, which we all watched that coverage. Then we saw him go through a very public divorce from a woman that was pretty well liked and admired. That all played out in public. Then comes these string of injuries. He's literally bedridden, can't get up, can't move around, can't swing anymore, gets an addiction to pain pills. He's relying on all kinds of medications. One by one, all of these things we watched, they were publicly out there. And I think the fact that he's rebounded somehow from all of that, it's a little easier to root for the guy on a more human level right now. Forget the golf for a second. It's great to see him admitting things now like, I'm not what I used to be. I can't do certain things that I used to do. There's things that I want to do now that I wasn't as good at before, like spending more time with my kids. He is, I think, easier to relate to now on a human level than he ever was when he was killing everybody on the golf course.
Jeff and I are of the mind that that DUI last Memorial Day weekend, when he was found on the side of the road about 15 miles from his house and near Jupiter, Florida, or in Jupiter, Florida, thinking he was in Los Angeles, California, headed down to his house in Orange County, California, completely out of it with this very potent, dangerous mix of painkillers and anxiety medication, five different drugs in his system. That was rock bottom for Tiger. It had all the sort of echoes of a Michael Jackson kind of an ending for this book. At that point in time, I don't think anybody could have predicted where Tiger was headed. But to see him, as I saw him in January at Torrey Pines, late January at the Farmers Insurance Open, engaged with people, appreciative, saying thank you, recognizing when people would say his name, acting more human than I had ever seen him. There was a gratitude, a graciousness, an appreciation, a humanity to Tiger that I hadn't witnessed before. It's not just me saying it and not just Jeff saying it. It's tour pros. It's people that interact with him on the tour have said the same thing, that he just seems more grateful at this second chance. And so you hope that's the way it goes, because he's 42 years old. He should change. People evolve. And you just hope that somewhere along the line, this programming has ended and, you know, the computer's shut off and an actual human being has emerged, you know, out of the darkness now. And you know, whether he wins again or not, frankly, I don't really care. I just think he's become a better person.
Tiger Woods is the book. Armin Katayan, Jeff Benedict are the co-authors. Thank you guys for being on.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And now the spiel. Either you torture or you don't. Seems reductive. It's actually not. It's a fascinating question without being an overly complex one. The United States tortures, it just does. We slam subjects' heads against the wall. We called it walling. Then the director of the CIA told Dianne Feinstein that we had discontinued the practice of walling. Discontinued the practice of walling. We convinced prisoners they're going to die, specifically that they were going to drown, to get info. That is torture. It just is. Here's the Red Cross's definition of torture. Torture, severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, inflicted for purposes of obtaining information. I've heard the argument that the suffering that was inflicted actually got good information and it was worth doing. I mean, that's fine. It might not be true, but let's just say it is. Doesn't make it not torture. So either we torture or we don't torture. But it works. It doesn't mean we don't torture. It just means we torture and it's effective. Or we torture and it's worth it. And I'm not even addressing if it's effective or it's worth it. Right now, I'm just saying that it's torture. Here's the fascinating thing with either we torture or we don't. I say we do. It is a shame, but we do it. John McCain says we do. It saddens him. But he knows what torture is, and he says and knows the U.S. has engaged in it. Agreeing with me, and John McCain, I guess, in their heart of hearts, are guys like Donald Trump and John Bolton. They know we torture. They don't mind we torture. But you know who disagrees with me, or at least who says they disagree with me? Who says we don't torture? Dick Cheney says that. John Woo says that. Gina Haspel says that. Because torture is a legal term, they will tell you. And since the Bush lawyers defined the practices as legal, then they can't be torture. Either we torture or we don't. Here's Dick Cheney literally telling Chuck Todd it wasn't torture.
Torture was what the Al-Qaeda terrorists did to 3,000 Americans on 9/11. There is no comparison between that and what we did with respect to enhanced interrogation.
So now we're mixing the legal definition with the colloquial. We don't torture because we got some legal advice and torture is a legal term. So I could say we don't torture. But then you could say, what about the victims of 9/11? What they went through is torture. Actually, legally, it's not. There was no attempt to find information. There's no attempt to exert pressure, intimidation, or humiliation. But of course, let's be real, those victims died in torturous conditions. Of course, the families were tortured because there is a real-world definition of torture and a common sense and common use definition, and Dick Cheney is using it right there, up to the point it stopped serving him. It's a horror what happened on 9/11. It's unspeakable. But guess what? The definition of torture has nothing to do with the goodness of the victim or the usefulness of the information. It's about the actions of the torturer. No definition of torture takes into account a single fact about the person being tortured. Once you start talking about who the people are or what they did, you stop talking about the torturer and you're obscuring the facts. This is also why we don't let countries who torture define what torture is. It's why I quoted the International Red Cross. I would wager that if we let all the countries ever alleged to have engaged in torture to give us a definition of torture, they might be a lot of different words and a lot of different languages, but they would all come down to, it's not what we do. So either we torture or we don't. And we can reform, maybe, I think we can reform the equation to be a people who don't torture, when in fact now we are a people who do. But I don't think a way we can reform is if we put the old torturers in charge of the new non-torture regime. So maybe I was a little unclear about what I think should happen to Gina Haspel. It looks like she'll be confirmed to run the CIA. She's the best we have, her defenders say. Involvement with this shameful program shouldn't disqualify those who were ordered to carry it out. I'm somewhat sympathetic to that. If you look at Gina Haspel's record as a torturer, she came to a site where there was dozens, if not hundreds, of instances, and she oversaw three, I think. So maybe in Bangkok, she showed that she was trying to lower the temperature. But then she burned the tapes. She got rid of the evidence of torture. So that's why I think this is what should happen to Gina Haspel. So she willingly destroyed the torture tapes against the instruction from the White House. I'm not calling for her to be fired or charged with crime. But that's one of those moments that a person should know that there's no going back from. That's one of those actions that once undertaken, it's done and you're done. You're out. When you burn the tape, you have to know that you're burning your career with it. It's what's called a hard choice. You can even make the case that Gina Haspel acted ethically. Maybe all her other CIA peers should, when they see her in retirement, ask how she's doing and compliment her new hobbies and then share a knowing remark about how what you did was brave and right and saved all of us. You know, two people, each acting ethically for their profession, can act in opposite ways. Like a businessman could hype up how his business is doing, and that's not unethical. That's ethical. He has shareholders or employees, and, you know, it's his job to see the world optimistically and to get customers to see that. But if a news person puts that hype-filled statement on the air without checking it, that's unethical. So one person's ethics is the other person's unethics when it comes to certain fields. Maybe the CIA is one of those fields. I think that Gina Haspel had a version of duty to help her fellow officers, and we want that from the Army or the Armed Forces or the intelligence community. We want them to have their fellow officers back. So perhaps as a CIA officer, she made the choice that was right for CIA officers. But now that we're all affirming that it was the right choice for America, that's where I make my objection. Because either we torture or we don't. Haspel burns the tapes, and that's her admitting that we do. And we confirming her to run the CIA is us all acknowledging the same. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé is a scratch golfer, but, you know, just in general, an itchy, itchy guy. Mary Wilson, just senior producer's father, named her Mary and told the world that she would be more important than Buddha, Martin Luther King, but probably not her brother. Steve Lickteig is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. He's going to use a 9-iron to lay up on 14. Oh, he's put it on the lip of the green. He will be able to get up and down in 3. The Gist. On our very first spear fishing excursion, we impaled 3 marlins, 2 perch, and a swordfish. We were asked to leave the aquarium immediately. Umperu deperu duperu, and thanks for listening.